Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Drama after criticism that certain scenes misrepresent the Clinton White House response to Osama bin Laden and are contradicted by the 9/11 Commission report. The path to 9/11 was purportedly based on that report. Commission Chair Thomas Kane was a paid consultant. Kane is now saying some scenes are being removed. And the children's publishing company Scholastic announced that it's yanking a website study guide produced as a classroom tie-in for the ABC special. About 25,000 teachers used the site. The pulled study guide included the suggestion that former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein had a role in the 9/11 attacks. That's been disproved, and today a Senate Intelligence Committee report says there's no evidence Saddam Hussein had a relationship with terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi or his al-Qaeda associates. Rick Klein is congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. Rick, how is this resonating in Washington?
Well, it's ignited a big firestorm, and Democrats have been calling for several days now for ABC to either yank this thing entirely, majorly edit it down, or have a running disclaimer saying that it's all fiction. And we're seeing now that it's beginning to have some impact with ABC and Scholastic's decision to actually make some changes here.
Well, the Detroit Free Press is reporting that the first scene to go shows former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger hanging up on a CIA agent who's seconds away from bin Laden. Kane, the 9/11 commissioner, now says the CIA was never that close to bin Laden and Berger never hung up on anyone. You write about two other inaccurate scenes.
One of the scenes that has drawn some fire has Sandy Berger in 1998 saying he doesn't have the authority to authorize an attack against bin Laden. And another scene uses a bunch of news footage to suggest that the Clinton White House was so distracted with the Monica Lewinsky affair and the impeachment proceedings that it missed some opportunities to go after bin Laden.
And what does the 9/11 Commission find about both those accusations?
In both cases, they say that there's no foundation there. So those are two particular points that have been majorly fought out in the media over the last couple of days and been a point of contention for the Clinton folks who've written a strongly worded letter demanding some changes. Madeleine Albright, Richard Clark, among others, are among those saying that this is a gross inaccuracy in this broadcast.
What's the significance to Democrats of the film's writer?
Well, the film's writer appeared on a panel that was aimed at increasing the right wing's influence in Hollywood. He's known to have a pretty close friendship with Rush Limbaugh, who's actually spoken on the air in favor of the film and talked about how this being really an indictment of the Clinton administration. So what they're saying, and one of the points they made yesterday, was that this is akin to having Michael Moore make a documentary about the Bush administration, and that, you know, the howls of protest would be on the other side in such a case.
Well, and what about Scholastic's role here? Again, its study guide has been pulled. As you write, the guide indicated that U.S. officials believe Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction but failed to add that weapons were never found. And as we said, drew a line between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. Is there any evidence of any connection between Scholastic and the White House?
No. I mean, and that's been a point of contention. And in fact, at some of the events in Washington, reporters have pressed the Democrats on whether this is Hillary Clinton's vast right-wing conspiracy. They haven't had any specific evidence to suggest that there's some connection between the White House or the RNC or any Republican officials, direct connection between them and this and the claims in the broadcast or in the teaching materials. But they point out that we're talking about 2 months before a midterm congressional election where President Bush and the Republicans are making national security a key issue. So to make any suggestion that President Clinton and Democrats had a chance to get Osama bin Laden and didn't do it is a pretty explosive charge.
And, Rick, does the film, while there's accusations it has unfair criticism of the Clinton White House, does it whitewash the Bush White House?
No. And in fact, it does show a couple of points along the way where there are opportunities that seem to have been missed or miscommunications within. And that's a point that ABC has made, is that this is, you know, equally critical of both administrations. Most of the attention has been on the depiction of the Clinton administration officials. So we'll see what the final product looks like.
Well, and as you said, even Thomas Kane, head of the commission, has said that some of the scenes in the film didn't occur. Any chance the film will be canceled?
I would find that hard to believe. I think ABC has spent a lot of money on this broadcast. They've also stood behind the writer and the director throughout. So I don't think that they would talk about canceling it. I think some editing is certainly in order between now and Sunday and Monday evenings. But in terms of cancellation, I think they'd take even more heat if they pulled it at this point.
Rick Klein covers Congress for the Boston Globe and has become our television reviewer today as well. Rick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, Scholastic, the children's publisher, now says they will create a new study guide on 9/11 that focuses on critical thinking and historical background. Well, that's the way our next guests say history should always be taught. Today and Monday, we're going to take a look at how 9/11 is being taught in the classroom. Joining us today, Josh Otlin, a high school social studies teacher in Hudson, Massachusetts. Josh, welcome.
Thank you.
And joining us from Brown University in Rhode Island, Susan Grasick. She's director of the Choices for the 21st Century Education Program at the Watson Institute. They develop a curriculum for schools dealing with a wide range of international issues. Susan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Josh, I want to start with you. You teach civics, history, ethics. What are you going to do on Monday?
This Monday with my students, I'll be doing an activity where I'm going to ask them to write a little bit of history and ask them to imagine that they are 50 years in the future and that they've been asked to write a U.S. history textbook, and they've got 2 to 3 paragraphs to explain what happened on September 11th and its significance and its causes and effects. And I'm going to ask them to discuss the time period between the September 2001 attacks and up to sort of the present day in the fall 2006. I'm going to tell them that I want to make sure that in their description they discuss the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan.
What do you expect's going to happen, Josh? Because these kids, how old are they now?
14 and 15 with my ninth graders.
Right. And so, you know, they've certainly been, you know, learning about this topic in school every year since 2001. But they were little kids back then. What do you expect?
I have some expectation that there's going to be potentially some factual confusion as to what exactly has happened on September 11th and in the years since. But I also expect that there's, I hope that there's actually going to be a wide range of responses coming from the students. And that's one of the purposes of the exercise, is to help the students see that when we're telling stories about events, that it's not as simple as saying, well, A, B, and C happened, but that there needs to be a lot of interpretation to come up with explanations of causes and effects and the relationships between different events in time.
You know, that brings you into territory that is sometimes, scary for teachers, because there's a lot of debate about a lot of these issues, probably debate going on around their kitchen tables at home. So, for instance, what do you do if a child says to you, we're in Iraq because Iraqis attacked us on 9/11?
Well, I think when students make statements that are factually incorrect, as a teacher, it's my job to correct them. Before we can get into issues of analysis and evaluation, we need to have a foundation for kids to build on. One of the things that this exercise does for me is it gives me a very quick assessment of what sort of foundational knowledge my students have. We're starting the new school year. These are students I haven't worked with before. And this gives me a snapshot of how they're understanding and making sense of what happened and what they actually do and don't know about what took place.
It's interesting, Susan Grasick, again, of Brown University and the Choices for the 21st Century Education Project, because Josh is going to do an exercise on Monday. In your project, you have students engage, I understand, in role-playing.
That's right. And actually, I was really interested to hear what Josh is going to do on Monday. I think it's a fabulous activity for the beginning of the school year for all the reasons he said. When we develop curriculum material on this topic, what we ultimately do is to frame the issue in terms of very different perspectives on the issue, so that we're not answering the question, why did this happen and what should we do about it? We're asking students to try to wrestle with that question or those questions. Mm-hmm. But they can't do that without knowing something.
Right.
And so what we do is to provide very carefully put together background materials that give them the tools to work with that. And then we ask them to look at these different perspectives on the issues. And ultimately, we ask them to deliberate together about the pros and cons of each of the directions that those options, as we call them, suggest, and then to figure out, well, what do you think?
Right now, we're understanding, and in fact, on Monday, we're going to talk to someone who has studied textbooks and how they cover 9/11. We understand that in many of them, there's a presumption that much of 9/11 is known to kids.
Kids who are high school students today were younger at the time, and some of them are well aware of it, and some of them are aware of something different. They're aware that every time they go to the airport, they have to take their sneakers off. And they're aware that they listen to the radio and they hear that our subways are not safe. Kids are scared by that stuff. So they know something's out there, but they don't necessarily know how to think about it. Second question, who did it? Well, we do know a lot about who did it, and it's worth putting that into the textbooks these days, too, and certainly that is in our curriculum resources that we've developed. Why? Why is extremely controversial, and it has a lot of hooks attached to it. And so what we want to do with high school-age kids is to engage them in that controversy. History is not a finished topic. Even if you go back and look at the story of history, it changes with time in the ways in which we understand it. But history also is something that doesn't end. History is made. And so we want high school kids to understand that we're making history today. We live with the history we make. When they go back into their history courses and study history and look at turning points there, those were just as open-ended at the time, and they were being shaped by people just like history today is being shaped. There are some really fabulous teachers who are trying to figure out how they can best deal with these topics in their classroom. And frankly, they're not waiting until the textbook can catch up. The textbook is not going to be the way they cover this topic. And so they are turning to supplemental materials. They are adapting those supplemental materials for their own classes because they're the ones who have the kids in front of them and know what they want to do with their own kids. And so I think it's sort of important to recognize that textbooks are not going to be the whole story of how 9/11 is dealt with, at least on the short term.
Josh, though, you say you don't use textbooks in your class. You use primary sources, political cartoons, documents from the time. And I'm just wondering again, looking at Monday coming up, we've talked about the teaching methods, but what do you do with the emotional aspect of this? These pictures are going to be all over the media again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the most important thing that we can do, first of all, is provide a space in our classroom for students to not just talk about the history, but to talk about their emotional reactions to what is taking place. If the classroom, particularly the start of the school year, if the classroom is simply my show, if it's a place where I'm on stage depositing knowledge into my students' head, we're not going to have a particularly good year together. And in some ways, I prefer that we didn't have to start the year with September 11th, but if we're going to, it actually provides us, I think, a really good opportunity to build some trust and some positive community in the classroom, to be there to support one another, and to have a safe space for kids to talk about things that, you know, maybe they're not going to talk about at the lunch table with their friends, and maybe they're not going to talk about when they go home. So if we have an opportunity to in my classroom, I think that's probably the best I can do.
Josh Otlin, high school social studies teacher in Hudson, Massachusetts, and Susan Grassick, director of the Choices for the 21st Century Education Program at the Watson Institute at Brown University in Rhode Island. Susan and Josh, thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And by the way, Susan's program provides supplementary materials to teachers in about a third of American high schools. So for more information on her project, you can go to our website here-now.org. Well, on Monday, we're going to take a look at textbooks and what they say about 9/11, and you might be surprised. A two-year study finds that many of the facts are missing. Osama bin Laden is rarely mentioned. And students are left with the impression that America is the main victim of terrorism. We'll have more on that on Monday. Just ahead, Iran's former president tours the U.S. and heads for Harvard. Some people say, why, on the eve of 9/11. So what is his message? We'll find out. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Conduct ourselves according to the message of the holy prophets, a message of peace, morality, truth, and the worship of God.
No Iranian of Hatami stature has traveled outside of New York in the U.S. since followers of Ayatollah Khomeini seized the American embassy in Tehran in 1979, taking 52 American hostages for more than a year. He's been met by other forms of protest as well on this visit. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, a possible Republican presidential candidate, criticized Harvard for hosting Hatami this Sunday, the eve of 9/11. Romney called the scheduled speech a disgrace to the memory of Americans who lost their lives at the hands of extremists and declined to provide state security. Well, why is the former Iranian president in the U.S., and who does he represent? Ashin Molavi is author of The Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom, a fellow at the New American Foundation, and he joins us now to help answer those questions. And Ashin, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Robin.
Well, first, tell us more about Khatami. He's a Muslim cleric, but also the liberal or reformist president of Iran. He was the first Muslim leader to condemn the 9/11 attacks 5 years ago. He called them barbaric.
That's right. He did. And you know, President Khatami, you know, hails from a clerical class in Iran that has in many ways been challenging the old guard in Iran, and they believe in a different view of the world, a world in which issues like democracy and freedom and tolerance and dialogue come front and center, whereas in the early days of the revolution, many of the clerical leaders spoke only of people obeying their rulers. And so when Khatami came forward in 1997, he was seen across Iran as this breath of fresh air. He excited this large, young Iranian population, two-thirds of whom were under the age of 30, half were under the age of 21. He dramatically changed the political discourse. But in many ways, today he's seen largely as someone with enormous potential as a cleric, a man of impeccable religious credentials who spoke of democracy and freedom, but who didn't deliver on his vision.
And so he was replaced by the hardliner, the current conservative president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and someone who, for instance, doesn't believe the Holocaust happened, and the former president, Khatami, does. But he is out of power. And even though you paint him as sort of like a Gorbachev figure, like Gorbachev with communism, Khatami trying to reform Iran from inside, others also point out that during his presidency, there were widespread human rights abuses. Nina Shea, Felice Geer of the U.S. Commission on International and Religious Freedom, writing that during his time, religious minorities, including Jews, Christians, even some Muslim groups, faced discrimination, torture, even execution.
Well, this is exactly right, and this is, you know, part of President Khatami's failure. While he was very good at speaking in abstract theoretical terms and using soaring language about the need for tolerance and dialogue and freedom, there were serious human rights abuses of the sort that you described, but also many of his most ardent supporters, some of the pro-democracy students who went out onto the streets, particularly in the late 1990s for a series of protests, and when they were jailed by hardline authorities, because at the end of the day, it is important to remember that the presidency is a weak institution in the Islamic Republic of Iran. President Khatami didn't stand with them with the same kind of force that they wished he would have stood with them. And there was, you know, still the jailing of journalists. Now, this is not to say that these were done on Khatami's orders, but Khatami was powerless to stop all of this. And some people felt like he didn't fight hard enough.
Well, now he's speaking on this idea of dialogue among civilizations. Following his advice, the UN adopted 2001 as the year of dialogue, and he's now sort of a respected member of a group called the Alliance of Civilizations. But what does it mean? You know, does it mean anything, first of all, back home, that he's traveling here and speaking?
I think it certainly means something back home, because in many ways the Iranian population is probably the most pro-American population in the region, and it's really ironic because I travel a lot in the region and I go to places like Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, places where we have strong political relationships and close political relationships, and I find the populations to be quite anti-American, whereas in Iran you have a government that is quite anti-American, at least in its rhetoric and in its actions to some extent, and you have a population that is very pro-American. You know, when Iranians were asked a few years ago if they would like to see their government restore dialogue with the United States, 3 out of 4 Iranians said yes, and the pollster was thrown in jail as a result of publishing those findings.
Well, that's the problem. And so, you know, here we have the governor here in Massachusetts refusing to provide security to Khatami because he's here on the eve of 9/11. And we read that some U.S. officials in the White House are a little miffed that he's here, in that they're in this tough debate with Iran over its nuclear capabilities. Does he have any impact in about the minute that we have, Afshin? Does he make any difference, and perhaps does he make a dangerous difference? Would Americans be misled to think that he represents the new Iran, or should they listen to him more?
Yeah, no, I think he certainly has some influence within Iran right now, but his group and his faction of reformists are by no means the ones driving the nuclear policy right now, and he's not ascendant. There seems to be the ascendancy of the hardliners as represented by Ahmadinejad, and a more pragmatic conservative camp as well that is really driving this issue. But what President Khatami does do in some ways is he's very good at speaking on these theoretical abstract terms of dialogue of civilizations, but what he hasn't been able to do is as I said, deliver on that abstract vision. But he may spur more Americans who are weary of a potential war with Iran. He may spur more Americans to engage and to push for greater engagement with Iran.
And at great risk to himself, we hear he may be defrocked when he returns to Iran. Afshin Molavi, author of The Soul of Iran, A Nation's Journey to Freedom, and a fellow at the New America Foundation on the former president of Iran's tour of the U.S. Afshin, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL. And The Economist, the weekly global magazine, with commentary and analysis on world politics, business,
at the World Trade Center site. Here Now's Rachel Gottbaum reports.
Today, Ground Zero is a construction site fenced off from the public, a place of silent memorials and tour guides.
As I said earlier, they're going to rebuild this site. What's going here, we don't know as yet.
Looking at the site today, it's hard to imagine that precisely 5 years ago, this was a scene from hell. When the planes hit the Twin Towers on 9/11, the buildings were pulverized. It's estimated that 2 million tons of dust containing cement, asbestos, glass, lead, PCBs, and other known carcinogens rained down on Lower Manhattan.
Now we saw on TV where all the dust was going. About how far did it go now that we're here?
Well, it depends which way the wind was blowing.
Ever since the attacks, researchers have been trying to understand the health effects of the dust and the smoke. Among them is Dr. Paul Lioi, a professor of occupational and environmental health at Rutgers University. Lioi took dust samples at Ground Zero soon after 9/11.
This is unprecedented. We don't have any benchmark from which to play from. We're looking at a material that's a mixture that we never, ever characterized before.
And for many of those who worked on the rescue and recovery at Ground Zero, there is no question that their medical problems are due to the air they breathed at the site.
My name is John Sforzo. I'm 51 years old.
John Sforzo was a construction worker who volunteered at Ground Zero.
Any place and every place you looked, the smell of death was in the air. You could smell the bodies burning or what was left of bodies burning. Sometimes the smoke was so bad your eyes would burn, you couldn't open your eyes. You'd have to feel in front of you.
Sforzo says at first he was just offered paper masks to protect against the dust and the smoke. He wasn't worried about toxic exposure because just days after the attacks, government officials said the air was safe. But he began to get sick.
I was starting to cough. And then I was coughing up these things that looked like silver dollars. They were silverish gray and sometimes there was blood in it. And then very short after that, I started getting severe lung infections and then succumbing to pneumonia. And I've never had pneumonia in my life, nor have I ever had any pulmonological problems.
Today, John Sforzo is on workers' compensation and federal disability because he has been diagnosed with reactive airway disease, gastroreflux disease, and post-traumatic stress disorder. More than 40,000 people worked in the recovery and rescue efforts at Ground Zero, and thousands of workers, including firefighters, police, and construction crews, have filed for workers' compensation and disability payments.
Okay, good deep breaths with your mouth wide open, please. And again. And again.
Dr. Robin Herbert is examining Daniel Lewis. Lewis delivered lunches to rescue and recovery workers in the days after 9/11. He is now disabled.
Good. What are the medicines that you're taking now?
I'm taking Flonase. I was on antibiotics. He was considering steroids because I have a hard time breathing.
Lewis is one of 16,000 workers from Ground Zero being evaluated at the World Trade Center Treatment Program at Mount Sinai Medical Center. The patients here range from undocumented immigrants who clean dust out of nearby office buildings to emergency service workers to firefighters who worked at the site for months. Dr. Herbert directs the program.
One of the things we saw was very startling. When we would look in people's nasal passages, it was as if the nasal tissue were just burnt out. It was bright cherry red. Our patients initially, they couldn't sleep through the night. They couldn't sleep for more than an hour. They were coughing so badly.
In a just-released study of 10,000 patients in the Mount Sinai program, 70% show signs of new and lingering health problems related to their time at the World Trade Center site.
One of the primary causes of the respiratory problems was exposure to pulverized cement and glass. The cement in particular was very alkaline, very high pH, extremely irritating, and we think that that then caused chronic inflammation in our patients.
The federal government is paying for Mount Sinai's monitoring of patients, but it's the Red Cross that's footing the bill for their medical care. 40% of those in the program don't have health insurance.
And I'm telling you today, thousands of people are going to die from this problem.
That's attorney David Warby. Warby is representing 8,200 clients who worked at Ground Zero and are suing New York City, federal agencies, and private contractors responsible for the cleanup.
This case is about thousands upon thousands of people who are sick, many of whom are dying, a lot more of whom will die because of the rush to clean up garbage after September 11th, when we were not saving lives because of a governmental decision and contractors' decisions to do everything possible to keep 50,000 people busy 24/7 with zero protection in the middle of the worst toxic waste site ever.
Neither the city nor federal agencies would comment on tape about the lawsuit, but they did issue written statements saying they provided respirators and urged workers to wear them. But less than half of the workers say they did.
We didn't have protection.
John Wolcott is a New York City police detective and one of David Warby's clients. Wolcott worked at Ground Zero and at the Staten Island landfill where the 9/11 debris was disposed.
Then when we finally got masks, one day on roll call, he said, you have to go back and exchange your mask. We put the wrong filters in. And then out in the Staten Island landfill, kind of hit home when you saw the FBI agents showing up in full hazmat suits and were, as you see me today, having civilian clothes.
In 2003, Wolcott was diagnosed with leukemia. He believes working at the 9/11 site caused his medical problems.
Well, when I got admitted to the hospital, that I was diagnosed that morning, and they said you had a week to live. The nurses were coming in and interview you, and they found out what form of leukemia I had. I fielded about 100 questions about, were you ever do any kind of employment with chemicals? Did I ever work in the airports? Did I ever deliver jet fuel? Was I ever around benzene? And I didn't put two and two together because I had other things going through my mind at that time. And my sister said, what do you think was burning down at the World Trade Center?
Wolcott thinks the fuel from the jets that crashed into the towers may be responsible for his cancer and his partner in the police department needing a kidney transplant. Attorney David Warby says the connection is obvious.
How does one partner have kidney failure and one have leukemia? And the only thing they have in common after 12 years of partnership is 911. I mean, sitting in my office a week and a half ago were six cops with leukemia.
5 years after 9/11, the question of the health effects from Ground Zero is a matter for medical researchers and the courts. New York City health officials have just announced a new $16 million program to monitor and treat residents of Lower Manhattan and 9/11 workers. The Bush administration has allocated $52 million for medical treatment. But federal officials admit that's not nearly enough for those who may seek medical care because of the effects of Ground Zero.
And that report from Here Now is Rachel Gottbaum. Coming up, author Claire Massoud, whose critically acclaimed new novel depicts the lives of privileged New Yorkers just before and on 9/11. You're listening to Here and Now. British scientists are saying that a 23-year-old woman brain damaged in a car crash last year is showing startling signs of awareness for someone in a vegetative state, perhaps even playing tennis in her mind. This is all reviving memories of Terry Schiavo, who was removed from life support last year and later died. A study in today's issue of the journal Science reveals that the young car crash victim was asked very specific questions to imagine herself playing tennis or walking through her apartment, and an advanced brain scan shows her brain reacting the same as a normal person's does. Researchers say that proves she intentionally decided to involve herself in the study. Well, joining us on the line is Arthur Kaplan, a professor and bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. Because, Professor Kaplan, this does raise ethical questions. So your first thought when you heard this report?
Well, I do think it is a very important study. It's not one that's been duplicated yet. It's only been done on one person, but you have to pay attention because the problem of deciding when to terminate treatment, when to end life support, is tied for many people to whether or not there's any form of awareness, consciousness, brain activity present.
This is, you know, a heartbreaking topic for, as you all know, for people who have had a loved one in a vegetative state or a persistent vegetative state or a coma. Can you, first of all, tell us, this woman is in a vegetative state. She was just in the accident a year ago. What's the difference between a vegetative state and a persistent vegetative state?
So when someone's in a vegetative state, it's the same as a coma. That means they're unconscious, they're not responsive, but it's possible that they could awaken. Permanent vegetative state means the brain has been damaged in such a way that any possibility of consciousness, sentience, awareness has permanently disappeared from the person.
Well, could you tell us what state was Terry Schiavo in?
Well, we know that Terry Schiavo was in a permanent vegetative state, and this study wouldn't have made any difference to the debate about her case because she had been the way she was for 10 years. And the data shows that people don't come out of circumstances like that after being unresponsive for 10 years. Plus, her brain had been scanned by CAT scan, and the cortex, the thinking part of the brain, had atrophied. The woman in the study, the woman who was CAT scanned and in the science report, she's not someone who is in a Terry Schiavo-like situation. Her brain has not been damaged. She's just not responding. Sometimes the way I explain this is, think of a TV set. Someone in a vegetative state or a coma, there's a scrambled signal on the TV. If you're talking about someone who's in a permanent vegetative state, you've damaged the picture tube and you can't get any kind
of
a picture whatsoever on there.
Well, so what dilemmas might this research pose for doctors and for families of patients? I mean, what does this say, that this woman might be on some level conscious and involving herself in a study?
It suggests she might be. One of the problems, too, with neurological efforts to scan the brain and say what somebody's doing or thinking is that we're not very good at that.
Well, I was going to ask you, Professor Kaplan, is it possible that in some way we don't yet know, there's just sort of a muscular reaction in the brain to a suggestion that it somehow doesn't go through any form of consciousness?
That's a very nice way to put it. And you might say she's having a reflexive response. Certain nerves are firing off in response to the stimuli. Let's say, pretend you're playing tennis. The word tennis sets off a firing pattern. It doesn't mean she's conscious. It certainly does mean you want to try and figure out more about what brain activity indicates vis-a-vis consciousness, but we're just at the start of that process. We're just starting to formulate the ability to scan the brain and say, think about X, let's see what brain patterns appear. Think about Y, let's see what brain patterns appear. So while I take this study seriously, it hasn't yet made me worry that somehow or another people have been abandoned or treatment has been stopped on those who might have been conscious when we thought they were not. If someone's younger, their brain is more adaptable, more malleable, and the chances for recovery are bigger, even when they're vegetative or unconscious for a prolonged period of time. I don't think this study should have people sitting at home and wondering, did I do the right thing by Grandpa when we said, you know, it's time to stop because he really hasn't been responsive for 2 years after a series of strokes. That's not the person whose head went in the scanner in this study.
Arthur Kaplan, professor and bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor, thanks as always.
Thanks very much.
Well, stay with us. More ahead, here and now. his arm, enters a ceremony in his honor observed by her friend Danielle, who will soon become Murray's mistress.
In this Hollywood version of Old New York, Marina and Murray advanced with the authority, the noblesse oblige, of leading players. An insignificant subset of society it might be, Danielle cast a skeptical eye over the assembled writers and journalists, a rumpled and bulging lot, even in their finery, but the Thwaites nevertheless had dominion over it. Oh, to be so easy.
Into this glittering world wanders Booty, Murray's nephew, like a slacker crashing a Vanity Fair party, the only one who seems to see they're all fiddling while Rome burns. And indeed, in the final pages, two planes hit the World Trade Towers and all of their little lives change. Author Claire Massoud joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And now, you've heard some of my words, but in yours, who are these people? You know, the Thwaites, first of all, and Murray Thwaite. Everywhere he goes, he leaves a wake. Everyone reacts to him. Mm-hmm. He hardly does to anyone else. And yet, you know, he's beloved. He covered great events.
Right. I think he's somebody who, in his youth, was pretty daring and ambitious and did a lot of original things. And then as he has grown older, he's 60 at the time the novel takes place. I think he's become an establishment figure and is somewhat wedded to his myth and society's myth about him.
A little bit maybe of a bloviator, although he thinks he might be, which makes him more interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
He has a little self-awareness.
Well, there's another character we haven't mentioned, Ludovic Seely. He comes to New York from Australia to start up a revolutionary magazine to take down people he perceives as blowhards, such as the aforementioned Murray Thwaite. And he marries Thwaite's daughter. Who is he in this mix? Who do you see in him?
In my mind, it's a generational clash between him and Murray. In part, an inevitable one. You feel you have to slay the fathers, you know, but also actually a philosophical one. My own moment at university, I'm a little older than these characters, but it was the moment when literary theory was very popular, and it was in tension, I think, with received liberal humanist understanding. So the idea that a work of literature was good, a literary theorist calls that into question. What does good mean?
Yeah.
What is good?
And Ludovic, I think somebody wrote, and maybe you did, he thinks truth is fungible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I did.
Yes, you did. Okay. And so there he is sort of shaking up everyone's lives. But would you, and I had the luxury of reading this not knowing that you were, that all of them were heading towards 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking, wow, they think things are important. You know, in my post 9/11 mind, reading this, thinking, they don't feel that important.
Yes. You know, I started this book early in 2001, and it was a book set in contemporary New York. And I was having trouble a little bit with the tone of it because it was hard for me not to be somewhat detached from my characters and a little bit knowing. It seemed important somehow to let people know that I wasn't preoccupied with the same things as my characters, or not entirely. And in some way, the momentous historical moment of 9/11, it made me leave the novel for some time. But when I came back to it, I felt I had more sympathy for my characters because they seemed suddenly caught in history. The people they were, that was over. That moment had ended. And all the things they took so seriously, none of us could take seriously anymore. And that seemed poignant rather than pathetic.
Well, and in fact, Ludovic Seely, for instance, and his now wife, Marina, Murray Thwaite's daughter, the magazine they were about to launch, you know, makes no sense. How can a magazine be revolution when they just saw someone else's idea of revolution crashing into the towers?
Right, right. For me as a fiction writer, I think for lots of people in the time right after 9/11, it was very hard to see the purpose of what a lot of us do. As I remember, it was very much a poetry moment. You know, prose somehow didn't fit the bill, but poetry, there was a... The lyric somehow could capture something of what people were experiencing in that time. But it was a very strange time because you did actually wonder, will anybody do them again?
Well, and in fact, you sum that up in the character Danielle, who has a point of view of this from her window. She can see the World Trade Towers when they're attacked. Let's listen.
She had seen the second plane like a gleaming arrow and the burst of it, oddly beautiful against the blue, and the smoke everywhere, and she had seen the people jumping from afar, specks in the sky, and she knew that's what they were only from the TV, from the great reality check of the screen, and she had seen the buildings crumble to dust.
She could smell them, even inside, even with the window sealed, the asbestos smoke, gasoline fuel, slight airplane, slight bonfire reek of it. She had seen these things and had been left forever, because in light of these things she did not matter. You had to make the right choice. You had to stay on the ground. But, God, the sky last night had been gorgeous, the colors, the lights, the towers, and after she let go of her terror, the joy of it. You had to stay on the ground, and there was no call to feel anything. There was nothing to feel, because you weren't worth anything to anyone. You'd had your heart, or was it your guts, or both, taken out. You'd been eviscerated. That was the word. And the Spanish woman singing last night, she had known. She had known all along. And now there was nothing but sorrow, and this was how it was going to be now, always.
The Spanish woman was the music that she was listening to the night before. We don't want to tell which character it is, Claire Massou, but one of them is thought to die in the events of 9/11, but doesn't. Instead, moves away and starts a new life. And as I was reading that, I thought, well, that could be cruel to 9/11 families who might still be holding out that maybe some fairy tale like that happened for them. And then I thought, well, no, wait a minute. Maybe this is also a wonderful metaphor about rebirth or something. What were you saying there?
The initial impulse for it came from a piece I read in the New York Times that actually I think there were a certain number of people who did take that opportunity to disappear. Mm-hmm. And it was known from their credit card use and their and so on that they didn't actually die, but they didn't go home to their families. Mm-hmm. But it's also true that for me, the character who does this, it perhaps sounds portentous or something to say so, but the character is the most American. Even though everybody's American except Ludovic Seely, but this character is the most American and in some way the most resilient, and in my mind is the survivor. In that sense, it did seem to me a note of, if not optimism, that might be too strong, I don't know, but certainly of some way through this terrible time, that there is a spirit that can't be kept down.
In fact, this character says, this is such an enormous amount of evil, maybe you could use this kind of hugeness for good or something. I'm trying to remember what the character...
It's about translating something from inside your head into the outside world. The idea that this had just been an idea in somebody's head. But what if you had an idea that was as powerful and a good idea? What would that be?
I want to quickly mention the title, The Emperor's Children. It refers, of course, to the emperor having no clothes. And I'm thinking Murray Thwaite was sort of emperor-ish, and the book is in part about his child. But also it's about her book, which is somewhat hilarious in that sort of pre-9/11 way that she's agonizing over the book she's writing about.
About children's fashions and what they say about our culture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you making fun of any of them, really, in with the things that they agonized over before 9/11?
No. I think it's hard when you care about people, even if you see them as making odd or frivolous choices, it's hard to make fun of them entirely. I feel I care a lot about these people I made up, and they feel like my relatives at this point. So I feel sometimes bemused by them or sad for them, or, you know, I have lots of reactions, but I don't think I'm making fun of them.
Well, Claire Massou, the new book is The Emperor's Children, about privileged New Yorkers right up to and right after the events of 9/11. Claire, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
You've changed. That sparkle in your eye is gone.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
It's all over now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What do high school textbooks say about 9/11? You will be surprised. Also, the report of the 9/11 Commission as a graphic comic book. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.